From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, it's National Black Business Month, and we're going to meet a Sullivan County business owner whose long entrepreneurial journey took her from a web business to her brick-and-mortar tea shop in Narrowsburg. Elias Guerra talks to Kendra Payne of the Herbal Scoop. It's coming up in the second half of the program. Plus, a new investigation says state facilities are detaining some prisoners in special watch cells without running water, sometimes for days or weeks on end. Patricio Rubio talks with Chris Gilardi, Justice Bureau Chief of New York Focus. And New Yorkers are pitching in to help victims of the earthquake in Columbia. That story in just a moment. We're going to start with environmental news in New York State, because a new legislative scorecard details how every New York State lawmaker voted on key environmental bills this year. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar has more.
The report by environmental justice group Environmental Advocates New York ranks every New York senator and assembly member against their environmental records during the latest state budget. Vanessa Fagens-Turner, executive director of Environmental Advocates New York, says she hopes the public uses the scorecard to hold their elected officials accountable.
The reason we do this scorecard is because I like to remind people, legislators have a power that the rest of us mere mortals don't have. They can vote. And what we do with our scorecard is track how everybody we elect to office to serve in New York State uses their vote to protect and conserve our environment, our water, and our clean air and climate. And there are 213 legislators in Albany. And what we did this year was, of course, not only track all of their votes, but we did a little something extra, which was also see how legislators used their public platform to speak out about their views about what happened to the biggest environmental story of the year, the weakening of New York State's climate law. 37 out of 213 legislators earned 3 points, which was as many as you could get, for using their platforms just to say anything about the climate law and that it was problematic, that it was being weakened. That, in my mind, is a pretty big story and headline. But we also have 73 legislators speaking out publicly in some fashion, supporting the climate law. We also can see big stories like the fact that we saw 0 of 4 super bills, which is a designation environmental advocates uses alongside many partners to indicate bills that have super importance and great consensus across the environmental movement. 0 of those 4 bills made it to the floor for a vote in the assembly this year. Now, there are good headlines too, but this was a pretty bellwether year. And I think another thing that's interesting is the year didn't have to go like this. There are a lot of headwinds facing Albany lawmakers. But had people decided to vote and lean in other directions, the solutions and offerings and programming and spending that could come from things like the climate law and super bills could also have helped address just those concerns.
The report released on Monday comes after Governor Kathy Hochul weakened the state's landmark climate law earlier this year. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly. Well, gun rights groups are suing New York State over a new law that they say bans the sale of a popular pistol. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
The new law prohibits gun shops from selling pistols that state officials say can be easily converted into machine guns. A new lawsuit claims that will take popular models by Glock off the market in violation of the Second Amendment. State Senator Mark Walczyk is a Republican from Watertown. He says it's already illegal to own a converted pistol, so the new law isn't necessary. Walczyk accused Democrats of trying to put gun shops out of business.
They're playing a game with firearms dealers and with law-abiding citizens to infringe on their Second Amendment rights.
Governor Hochul says converted pistols have been recovered at crime scenes around the state. She says the new law makes the state safer, and she'll defend it in court. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Central New York is stepping up to help survivors in Columbia, where the death toll from an earthquake there has risen to nearly 300 people. Randy Gordman of the New York Public News Network reports the call to action was organized by a Colombian native now living in Utica.
Welcome. Thank you. Ladies, señoritas, qué pena.
Ingrid Quiseno is the driving force behind an effort held over the weekend to collect non-perishable food, flashlights, and other goods. They will ship the load to Colombia, where a 7.4 magnitude quake ravaged part of that country a week ago. Quiseno, who emigrated from Colombia several years ago and still has many family members living there, is an active volunteer in Utica organizations, and she says that passion for helping others is pretty common in this central New York City.
Utica is a wonderful city that is very humanitarian, is known for that, for supporting the immigration. So I'm thankful I'm here, and because I have volunteered for many years as well, I have enough connections that I felt I could create an impact.
Among the others helping gather donations is Cuban native Josue Gonzalez, who moved to Utica some years ago.
Even if we are not over there, we feel that because everybody have family, everybody have like home, everybody have like, you know, things that you just belong with you every time, but people like just love everything like that. That's why we're just working hard here.
Many who visited the donation center in Utica stopped to write their names and leave a message of encouragement on what organizers called a united hands wall, so that when their words and deeds reach the Colombian people, they will know Central New York is sending a message of strength and unity. In Utica, Randy Gorman for the New York Public News Network.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for those reports. I'm Jason Dole, and it's the local edition. Coming up, we'll meet Kendra Payne, owner and operator of the Herbal Scoop in Narrowsburg. Right now, it's time for our feature interview. And it's a big one, an update on the carceral system in New York State, something that we cover regularly and often with the help of New York-focused Justice Bureau Chief Chris Gilardi. He has a new article out detailing the use of special watch cells in state facilities. That's where corrections personnel detain prisoners suspected of ingesting contraband. Sometimes they're there for days or weeks, in poor conditions, even without running water. For more Radio Catskills, Patricio Robayo spoke with Chris Gilardi earlier this afternoon.
First, let's talk about exactly what is a contraband watch room and why does even the state even use them in the first place?
Sure, yeah. So a contraband watch room is a room inside a New York State prison. They've been in use for quite a while, at least a decade per my research, but likely much longer. And you know what they are? They're these rooms inside the prisons where officers or prison staff and prison administration can send people if they suspect that they have ingested, you know, any sort of contraband, usually drugs or weapons, but it can be anything. And either ingested them by swallowing them or hiding them in like a body cavity. And, you know, the idea is that they send them to these rooms and in like a sort of controlled environment, so they can basically pass the contraband and, you know, not flush it down the toilet or anything and you know, not recover it to either like use the drugs or use the weapon and sort of be harmful within the prison. You know, that's the idea. And basically the reason that I was interested in investigating these is because they're very brutal rooms. We have anecdotes of people being locked in them 24 hours a day. You're not let out unless they're like giving you medical care or taking you to like get an x-ray or a scan or something to show that the contraband is supposedly still inside you. We have anecdotes of people being held in them for days, weeks, even like upwards of 2 months, you know, like 24 hours in these rooms. The rooms don't have any running water. You're supposed to like clean yourself and you're supposed to defecate in a bedpan so they can like inspect it to see if the contraband has passed. At least in the ones that we've been hearing about, the windows don't open. The lights are actually on 24 hours a day. That's per prison policy. And yeah, they're extremely sort of like brutal places to send someone basically under the guise of safety.
Yeah. And you opened your article with Rakeem Brown at the Green Haven Correctional Facility If you want to talk about exactly what happened to him, I know he says that he was held there for 8 days.
Yeah, so Rakeem Brown's story is pretty remarkable. He actually was in a contraband watchroom twice over the span of several weeks, both for about a week at a time. What happened to him, and this is sort of like we've been hearing anecdotes about, is, you know, people being sent to these contraband watchrooms under pretty weak suspicion of holding contraband, and, you know, spending a lot of time in these sort of horrific rooms trying to prove that they don't actually have anything. So what happened to Brown was, it was after he had a visit with his wife. His wife visited Greenhaven. And after visits, generally, at least recently, incarcerated people pass through these like advanced imaging body scanners that the prisons have. And, you know, these scanners, they sort of like use X-ray technology. It's not exactly an X-ray, but it can like show anomalies like within, like on your body. And he said that officers said that the scan showed that he had contraband like in his rectum. And he, you know, he denies that. He said that there wasn't anything, or he wasn't having anything. So they sent him to this contraband watchroom for 8 days. It took for them to be convinced that he actually didn't have anything. The prison agency's stance is currently that he did have something, but they never actually recovered any contraband. So he went there for 8 days. And then about a week later, he had another visit with his wife. And after that visit, actually incarcerated people can like opt out of the body scans. So he underwent like a strip search instead of like going through the body scanner after the visit. And after that, the officer who was strip searching said that they alleged that he had something in his rectum again, and he spent another week in the contraband watchroom, and again they didn't recover anything, even though the prison agency is still accusing him of having contraband.
Yeah, you know, that's something, as you're talking, I was thinking about, you know, what does it take to convince the prison officials? Because, you know, you talk about the contraband rumor, and you mentioned scans, so I don't know, what are these, are they doing like X-ray scans like do at the doctors, or do some kind of body scan like they do at the airport? Are there different ways that these the correctional officers can be convinced that the prison or the incarcerated person doesn't have any kind of contraband in them?
Yeah, so it's a great question. They do use sometimes like X-rays or like these advanced body scanners. I will note that, and we've actually talked about this on the show before, these body scanners are known to be a little bit unreliable. The readings are very subjective. We wrote a story actually last year about visitors going through the body scanners and officers mistaking things like their IUDs or like their tampons, or, you know, just like bodily like scars or other like very normal anatomical anomalies for contraband, and accusing them or falsely accusing them of trying to smuggle in contraband. So yeah, they do use these body scans, and they do use X-rays to try to disprove or to see if the person still, to see if the scans are still showing what they interpreted as contraband. Another thing that they do is they actually like have these prisoners like defecate into a bedpan and then show them that they don't have any contraband in them. And what happened in Brown's case is he said he did that over and over and over, but the officers said that he wasn't defecating enough and it didn't count, and it wasn't enough to prove his innocence. So it took days more of that whole process to show that he no longer had anything in his body or never had anything in his body to begin with. So it's very subjective. The way that the directive that has the prison agency policies that outline the procedures that dictate the use of these rooms, it gives officers and prison administration pretty wide leeway to extend the amount of time that people are in them.
Yeah. Now, there's another case you talk about, I hope I pronounce his name right, is Jaquan Griffin at the Eastern Correctional Facility. What happened in this case?
Yeah, this is another interesting case, and I think this really speaks, Jaquan Griffin's case, I think, speaks to criticism that even when someone does have contraband, that these rooms are overused and abused and often, you know, not the safest or the best way to actually, you know, take hold of contraband that someone has like ingested or stowed in their body. So with Jaquan Griffin, he was at Woodburn Correctional Facility originally, and he got into a fight. And a fellow prisoner like attacked him and punched him and actually broke his jaw. And when he was taken to the hospital, an X-ray showed that he had like a razor in his sort of like rectal area. Now this is where sort of like the stories diverge. It's pretty clear that the prison accused him of stowing that sort of like in his rectum. He says that he had stowed it in his mouth and accidentally swallowed it. It was wrapped in plastic, so it wasn't just like a sharp loose razor like in his body. But whatever the case, they took him from the hospital still with a broken jaw and still with this razor in his body and sent him to a contraband watch room for several days. And they were insisting that he pass the razor, but it just like wasn't coming out. He said he was trying as much as he could to get it out of his body, but it was pretty much lodged in his intestines. And yeah, eventually it took several days, multiple like hospital visits. They scanned him again to make sure that the razor was still in there. And he was just sort of like begging for care, both for his jaw and for this sharp object that he was worried could sort of like puncture something in his body. And it took about a week actually for the prison system to take him back to another hospital. And there, you know, they fixed his jaw and they also performed like a colonoscopy to get the razor out, you know, more surgically rather than just passing it, which is what the officers were sort of insisting. And, you know, this is a case where this person definitely did have contraband and it was sort of like trying to pass it, and instead of like getting him medical care, the prisons, you know, were really, really just relying on these rooms and sort of like stowing these folks away until the situation kind of resolved itself, which it actually didn't end up doing in this case.
And Chris, you know, we've talked in the past about the HALT Act, and which was to New York passed this law to limit prolonged solitary confinement. And I understand from your article that advocates believe that this contraband watchroom sort of may violate that law.
Yeah, so this is an interesting update to that whole saga, which is, you know, been in the works for years. So under the HALT law, you know, there are some exceptions, but generally speaking, if you're keeping someone in a room for longer than 17 hours a day, there are like really strict limits. Like you can't do that for more than a few days. You also have to like schedule a sort of like hearing to get them out of the room. They also have to be given like a certain amount of programming and sort of like out of cell time, even if they're mostly in their room. The prison agency's perspective is that is only for discipline issues. So that is only for like solitary confinement that is used as like a punishment for like violating rules or committing violence or something like that. But that's not really how the law is written. The law doesn't make that distinction. And advocates, lawyers, the state senator, Julia Salazar, who's the main one responsible for passing the law, said that's actually not a good distinction that happens in the law, and that like any sort of cell confinement is ruled by docs or is ruled by HALT. So they're saying that the practice of these contraband watchrooms actually, it violates the law. And, you know, the prison agency says otherwise. It's an interesting question. There's been like lawsuits that have been arguing over like similar questions. Like, can the prison agency say that this isn't discipline, so it actually doesn't fall under HALT? As far as I know, there hasn't been a real definitive answer on that in the courts. And I think like the main lawsuit on that front is in settlement talks right now. But yeah, I'd be curious to see how a judge would interpret each side's interpretation of the law when it comes to these contraband watch rooms.
Yeah. And well, let's talk about some of the criticism that the docs have they responded to these criticisms about these practices, you know, that it amounts to another form of solitary confinement?
Yeah, so they basically say it's a security and a safety measure. And they say that there are pretty strict procedures that ensure that these rooms are used safely. It is part of the directive that staff have to keep medical, like docs medical staff in the loop when using these rooms, and any sort of like extended use of them has to go through a sort of approval process via like higher ups in each facility. And they also, you know, they point to the fact that contraband, specifically drugs, are a real safety issue in the facilities, which is true. I think that a lot of the critics of contraband watch rooms agree with that. And, you know, there's like a lot of overdoses and a lot of really nasty stuff getting inside the facilities. But the critics say that this is over the top. It's a way to sort of like intercept drugs that is easily abused and not humane.
You know, as you know, after doing this reporting, you know, what do you think the public should understand about these rooms that they're, you know, that they probably didn't know before? Because, you know, you're right. You know, there's one half of it that there has to be some kind of system to, because there are people who are bringing contraband into the prisons. And but at the same time, there has to, I guess you're saying that it has to be some sort of fine balance between having some decency to human beings at the same time, still protecting other folks within the inside the prison system.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. It's a tough balance. I think especially through the two specific stories we just talked about earlier on in the segment, I think that a takeaway, at least for me, as someone who covers the prison system a lot and has for several years, a main takeaway is that the way that these systems often work is that they put in place something that is supposed to, you know, that has like an understandable sort of impetus behind it. Like when someone is found to have contraband in their body, there has to be like a safe way to recover it. And then they put these policies in place, and then those policies are pretty sparse and they leave a lot of room for interpretation. And frankly, they leave a lot of room for abuse, and with little oversight, something that may make sense on paper really just becomes like a sort of runaway train and can lead to a lot of, yeah, really horrible and inhumane things. I think it really points to what I think critics have been saying about docs for years, is that it needs a lot more oversight.
Chris, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know? Or
I don't know. I would say we're still trying to investigate these rooms. We've only have a few anecdotes, even though we know that they're in wide use and that they're in use across the prison system. So if you have a loved one who has experienced anything with these rooms, we are always looking to talk.
Well, Chris, again, thank you so much for this. We're talking to Chris Giraldi of New York Focus about the outlet's investigation into New York's use of special contraband watchrooms in state prisons. Like Chris said, the investigation found that incarcerated people suspected of concealing contraband can be held for days or even longer in these cells without any running water while under conditions of observation. And critics say that the practice can amount to prolonged isolation, while the State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision says the rooms are an important security measure used to prevent dangerous contraband from entering the correctional facilities. You can read Chris' full article, Investigation, at New York Focus. Chris, thank you again so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Thank you, Patricio, for that conversation. And big thanks, as always, to Chris Giraldi for his work at New York Focus. I'm Jason Dolan. We do have one more story for you tonight here on the Local Edition. Kendra Payne's road to opening her Sullivan County tea shop was a winding one. After years working in health and wellness, she opened her first brick-and-mortar store 5 years ago. As the nation marks Black Business Month, WAMC's Lower Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Elias Guerra visited the store to learn more about Payne's journey.
A cafe sign listing teas and lattes welcomes customers visiting the Herbal Scoop. Then the wall is filled with even more tea options, from black to milky oolongs, as well as tulsi, ashwagandha, marshmallow root, and yerba mate. The Narrowsburg shop was founded by Kendra Payne. She says she's been a tea lover for many years. Her vitamin tea blend is one of her favorites at the moment, and she opens a container of it to show me.
That smells wonderful.
Yeah.
It smells like minty and
yeah, there's like a little bit of spearmint in here. There's some oat straw and lemongrass. There's lots of good herbs. You can kind of see the like red clover flowers coming through. It's a really light and bright tea, mellow. You can really mix it with, like, if you wanted to like have some sort of like a loaded water for like electrolytes, adding in some berries, maybe a little bit of honey.
For years, Payne worked in the wellness field, often as a fitness or yoga instructor. All the while, her love of tea lurked in the background.
In like my yoga teaching and having clients, people were always asking me like, what are you drinking? Why does your skin look so good? Why aren't you ever sick? You know? And I was like, oh, this is like my ginger turmeric tea, or this is my chamomile, or whatever I was drinking at that time. And people were like, well, share me the recipe. Like, I want to do what you're doing.
She says she's been dabbling with herbalism since 2005 and went to school to formally study it in 2012. Finally, she opened her first brick-and-mortar store in 2021 in Calicoon, one town over from where she is now. In addition to selling a variety of drinks, Payne also grows about one-third of her herbs on her farm nearby. I asked her about some of the challenges of running a business in rural New York as a Black woman. She says it's an honor, especially since Black-owned businesses often have an uphill battle.
Historically, our businesses have been, you know, underfunded. It takes a long time to build trust, and that's just the way that it's been. And especially for Black women-owned businesses, it is very, very difficult, if ever, for our businesses to hit, you know, the first milestone, which we say in small businesses, like $100,000. It is like less than 1% of women-owned businesses are able to hit that, and not because they don't have the product or not because it's, you know, priced right, just because we don't have the financing and the opportunities. When we go in to ask, whether it's bank or venture capital or whatever is going on, we are getting turned down more times than any other demographic, and that's really hard to deal with.
According to an analysis by LendingTree, in 2024, the denial rate to lines of credit or cash advances for Black businesses with 1 to 4 employees was twice as high as white businesses. According to New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, Black businesses make up only 3.5% of all small business owners in the state, even though New York's population is more than 14% Black. Payne says she'd like to see some of the barriers come down.
I would like for it to be easier for us to open our doors. It is quite a feat as a Black-owned business to get support, to get financial support. I would just like for it to be all a lot easier. I would like the trust building, the community building. You know, if we make a mistake, let it not be at the detriment of our business, but to let us be able to learn and for our communities to be able to forgive us. I would like for us to have access to capital and mentorships. There's just a lot of stuff that's really hard, and there's a lot of barriers around as a Black-owned business, and especially as a Black woman-owned businesses, that we just don't get. And those doors need to be open to us just as much as anyone else.
Payne is driven by her love for the products she sells. She says it's important for her to keep herbalism accessible, which is why she loves tea so much. Besides the vitamin T, she says it's tough to pick some of her other favorite blends.
And can you talk me through some of your favorite blends that you have created yourself and, you know, what went into those?
Oh, that's really difficult. Oh, it's really difficult. Okay. I would probably say, I'm sorry to all my other teas. Oh.
She picks one called Holy Chai, filled with tulsi, cardamom, cinnamon, ginger, orange peel, and cloves. Then she opens a jar of bright red hibiscus, and the smell fills the air.
It does really well as both a hot or iced tea, and like it's delicious on its own, but also has a ton of benefits, tons of antioxidants. It's really heart supportive. And so, you know, you think you're getting a delicious cup of tea, which you are, but it also has tons of benefits. And I love being able to bring herbs like that forward so that it's easy for people to start an herbal ritual and not have to like choke something down that's really disgusting. Like, you can get there in your herbal journey, but if you're first starting out, you might want something like hibiscus to be able to, you know, support your wellness goals.
Apart from her shop on Main Street in Narrowsburg, Payne also has a pop-up stand in Beacon every other Sunday and at the Berryville Farmers Market until October. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
Thank you, Elias, for that story, and thank you, listener, for being here with me. I'm Jason Dole, and that is it for the local edition tonight. Remember, we've got more news, local news, regional news, statewide news, anytime you need it, up at WJFFradio.org or on the Radio Catskill mobile app. Coming up at 7, we got Mr. Kusar Grace with the Music Emporium, 2 hours of great music for you. Followed by Ambient Barn. For now, stay with us because we've got more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Hey, folks, I'm Alzo Slade from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's the NPR News Quiz, where we make fun of the news and chat with funny people like Hasan Minhaj.
Your parents were not up for you being a comic.
Yeah, they're not. They weren't really into it, but that's because they loved me.
Make your parents proud by staying up to date on the news with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.